I'm in for Jerry this week, and I want to begin the show by asking you a question. Whether you're at home, your car, maybe you've taken the day off, you're at work. Growing up, were you taught about the middle ground? Finding that middle ground, consensus. Learning how to meet people halfway. In negotiations, it's called a win-win. Both sides give up a little to get a lot. I guess my question to you is, this middle ground disappearing? Are we seeing this great and growing divide pulling at society and our psychology? Politics, populism, and socialism. We're voting out versus voting in. Wealth, the have and have not, a massive concentration of wealth with a handful. While many of us are living paycheck to paycheck, and the middle class is disappearing. How about our psychology, the certainty and security we all dreamt of? Yet when it comes to jobs and livelihood, this is becoming the domain of the public service, guaranteed jobs, guaranteed retirement, where the taxpayers who fund the bill have little or none. And now look at our border, Canada, U.S., proud allies, always counted on each other, now caught in mudslinging and rhetoric, more about the narcissistic tendencies of our leaders versus what's right for the country. And unemployment, media becoming fringe-based, even game-changing, life-threatening things like climate change and terrorism and artificial intelligence were pulled apart by different points of view. So standing on this shifting sand, I don't like the feeling. I like to have a firm footing. So this week, we're going to try to bridge some of these great divides through conversation, through interaction, through opening minds. We're going to look at politics and education, economy, infrastructure, what's possible for Canada. So let's get going with our morning panel. Joining me, Sandy Nunziata. He's a Niagara Regional Councilor from Fort Erie. Jennifer Innes, Regional Councilor, Ward 3 and 4 from Caledon. And Randy Ramin, Principal at Navigator. And Randy, I want to start with you because you are called upon to shape opinion a lot. Do we find now that we're talking about what's right to get me elected versus really the kind of conversations we should be having with voters?
I don't know if it's worse now than it ever has been. I think politicians, sorry, we've got two politicians on this panel, but I think that, you know, oftentimes, especially the closer we get to election season, people make decisions based on not only what's best for my constituents, what's best for the communities I serve, but what's best that's going to get me reelected. And though I'm not saying it plagues everybody, there's no question that that filter probably comes to mind, especially let's look at Toronto City Council now that's facing, you know, a major election in November. Is it November or October?
October.
Sorry about that. And, you know, there's most of the decision making, most of what we're hearing are trying to shape what voters are going to be thinking about as they go to the election box, as they go to the ballot. And so, you know, I would say that this is probably nothing new. It's just so much more open and raw maybe than it has been in the past.
So Sandy, Randy's point is maybe it's always been the same. I question, is democracy broken? I mean, we had this last election, provincial election, we have festering sore upon festering sore. Nobody came out and said, listen, we got to take some tough love. We got to get fiscally responsible because you can't get elected by being open and transparent. So you start spinning it every which way. Is democracy broken or is it just simply this is a sign of the times where media is simply amplifying what's always been there?
Yeah. So I don't think democracy as an institution is broken. What I do think is that there's a lot of self-serving and self-righteousness that comes out in a lot of the political rhetoric that we've been hearing through election cycles. I think it's a simple lesson to learn. The people are never wrong. Listen to what their needs are and try to convey that through your policies and through how you craft public policy. That way, basically, you're doing the will of the people. And I think that's the job of every elected official to make sure they're listening, make sure they're leading, and make sure that they're bringing those plans to fruition.
So, Jennifer, is that happening? Because I look at politics right now saying we're bearing a lot of cement at the foot of the next generation. This boring upon boring upon boring. Nobody seems to be accountable for spending. Are we really listening to the taxpayers, or are we just kind of saying, this is what's going to keep me in-house for the next 4 years?
I think that they listen typically when it becomes time for re-election. And I think this is another reason why we need to start looking at maximum length of serving. Mm-hmm. So, you know, only spending, I would say, no more than 3 terms in one position is the max. If you can't do what you need to do to help improve and to be a good, solid voice for your community in 12 years, you shouldn't be there anymore. And that's not to say that you can't take a role in another level or another position to help serve your community. But I think a lot of times people people get stuck in that cycle that they do make those decisions based on that.
Yeah, but you're talking about term limits, though, in 12 years. I'd like to think if you can't get done or fulfill the promises you've made in 4 years, it's called an election.
It's called an election.
And they will vote you out.
Oh, but don't you think, I kind of like Jen's idea about term limits, because I think then you're going to get politicians who are brave enough to make some of the tough decisions without worrying about getting booted out the door. I actually think it's the last term where they're not worried about re-election that you're going to see the bravest decisions from elected officials.
But we just saw a lot of dialogue in the media over the last weekend about how almost impossible it is to let people go within the public service, right? Is accountability something that's missing that says, and you talk about accountability, if I'm not accountable to my promises, I won't get elected. But accountability in general in the public service, is that an issue where people are losing trust in the system?
Well, but for good reason. I mean, we've got collective bargaining. We've got unions that make it very difficult to make some of the tough decisions that elected officials need to make.
But we're a democracy. Why can't we change that?
Why can't we change it? I think that it depends too what level of government you're looking at. If you're looking at municipal, I think that there is a greater chance to turn over, to be quite honest. And I think when you're looking at federal and provincial, it's a party thing. And we just saw a case where people weren't voting in the PCs. They were voting out the Liberals. That was the decision. However, the next election is going to be different because it's going to be either people are going to be voting to keep the PCs in power or they're going to be voting to vote them out. So I think it depends on what level of government we're looking at. But I think another aspect of this is social media. And social media has greatly changed how accountable our politicians are to their taxpayers.
Sandy, last word.
Yeah, but to your point, when you opened up the segment, Tony, about populism, and I have never seen a greater concentration of ideologues run for elected office over the last decade. And that's the problem.
Tony Chapman in for Jerry Agar. Coming back, we're going to be talking a little bit about Ontario Place. Welcome back with Sandy Annunziata, who's got the most amazing tan. I mean, if this was television right now, I mean, we're talking about, I haven't seen that since Cops and that Eric guy used to drive around on a motorcycle. You're just looking gorgeous. Jennifer Ennis is the Regional Councillor, Ward 3 and 4. And Randy Ramit from Principal and Navigator. The text board was lighting up and people saying, what about business? What about bankers? We'll get to that this week because I think this concept of artificial intelligence, taking automated checkouts, taking consumers off the workforce is criminal. We'll get to that. Don't worry. There's getting no free pass. But right now I want to talk about opportunity. Because sometimes I think, you know, we miss opportunity. Every time I drive along the Lakeshore, I love taking the Lakeshore in, and I see this Ontario Place. What city in the world wouldn't want to have Ontario Place as something to reimagine and reinvent? We're talking about the most extraordinary land, and yet it's sitting there like a rust bucket. What is going on? You know, they started bringing it back. They had proposals. This came in, that came in. Again, it's been stalled. Is there anything we can do as citizens of Toronto to say, we want that waterfront and make it happen because it's going to drive tourism and the psychology of our city. Sandy, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, that should be the plan. You know, you put it out to tender to see what opportunities exist. You make sure that it stays accessible to the public at large. You make it a destination location and you make it this hub of innovation because I'm telling you, they're not making any more waterfront anymore. So as long as you can make sure that you maintain the accessibility, because that's huge. That's huge. Having people access the waterfront is huge for any community. And Toronto is so lucky to have that parcel of property. Now you got to do it right.
But Jennifer, we've been talking about having to do it right. This thing is becoming a rust bucket. We're coughing up hairball after hairball. What does it take for people to start voting and saying, actually, we want to invest or get the private sector, somebody, to repurpose that land? Isn't that like one of the greatest embarrassments, especially with Porter Airport there that you fly over and go, what is that down there? Nothing.
Well, and I think, you know, everybody talks about Toronto's waterfront and trying to rejuvenate it and to making it an inviting place, not only from the water, but from the downtown core. And, you know, Mississauga and the Region of Peel are doing their part in rejuvenating their waterfront to make it attractive and rebuilding some of our wetlands. And I think that this is an opportunity to bring back the center of attraction. I mean, when I was a kid, that was the place to be. That was the place to go. And then as we got a little bit older, the concerts, that was always fun. I still go to concerts there. So I think rejuvenating it, I think they lost an opportunity. I know there was a huge debate and a war about whether or not to put a casino there, but I think that was an opportunity to draw in not only tourism, but a serious amount of dollars that the city could well use on other things like housing and maybe combating some of this gun violence.
So, Randy, Navigators called upon a lot to shape policy. And so what would you do to shape the thinking to make sure that that Ontario Place can come alive?
You see, the biggest problem with Ontario Place is that there are too many interested stakeholders and too much money at stake. And so what that leads to is paralysis in decision making, because everyone wants to make people happy and you can't make everybody happy. And so it becomes impossible. In fact, our previous host, John Tory, actually chaired a commission to look into the future of Ontario Place. It was one of the things he did, I think, before taking public office and before working here as a host. You know, people have spent a lot of time thinking about the future of Ontario Place. People have a lot of opinions. Should it be kept public? Should it be public lands? Should part of it be public? Should part of it be private? Should we build condos like the rest of the waterfront, or should we do something different with it? And because it takes a lot of big thinking and big decisions, we're paralyzed. I would say, though, that there has been a process. There was a process to submit bids as to what a variety of different interested stakeholders came forward with their points of view. And the provincial government has now come forward and said, stop, we're not going ahead, because it envisioned public money. And so is there the big question I think we need to ask ourselves, is there a way forward without any public money? And is that in the best interest of taxpayers? Because though it's sexy right now for Doug Ford to say, I'm not going to spend any public money on anything, ultimately, and I think part of this is just finding some provocative things where you could say, I'm stopping things. So you could see I'm stopping the bleeding. Some of them are meaningful, some of them aren't. I question how meaningful this one is.
Well, I've got to look at, especially with our manufacturing disappearing, NAFTA issues, tourism is going to become vital. It's 10% of the world economy, employs 11% of the people. It's actually somewhat competitive immunity in the sense technology can't replace service. So it's so important to us. You know it at Niagara. Why are we thinking about this as a return on investment versus just spending?
Exactly. And that's the investment you have to make. And that's the mindset you have to get into. You have to reclaim your waterfront. I'm telling you, Tony, there's some great templates already out there. If you look at the Rust Belt Renaissance that's gone on in Cleveland, you look at Buffalo, just an incredible job with their waterfront, revitalizing their waterfront, bringing people there, destination location. There's some great opportunity there. And you do have to partner with the private sector, because the taxpayer cannot foot the bill. But there's some great creative partnerships you can get into. And the template is already there. And I'm not going to get into that big U.S.-Canada rhetoric that everyone else has jumped on the bandwagon. I love our partners in Western New York. I love our partners in the United States. There's some great players that can bring some great concepts and some great innovative thinking. And they can show us the way.
So I'm going to ask you a point, because there's two politicians on it, but we talk about a partnership with the private sector. We tried to do that with Union Station. It was supposed to be finished for the Pan Am Games. It's still a disaster. You walk into it, it looks like we are a third world country. To get to a basketball game, you got to walk outside through 1,000 smokers as your gauntlet to go to see athletes play. How do we envision that the government's going to get involved and make intelligent decisions about what is right for the public going forward? Have I lost faith? Am I the only one losing faith? Go ahead.
Well, just like I think any other major construction project, Union Station has been, you know, triple the price and double the length of time. And I'm not surprised in any way. That happens in the private sector. That happens in the public sector.
No, the private sector doesn't stick around if you do that.
If you've renovated your kitchen, you know this is true. But I know that's on a much smaller scale. What I would say is there are public-private partnerships, PPPs, where you can actually get in. And there are consequences in the contracts that you write where the private sector is incented to be on time and on budget. And I don't know, I think the fault is probably with the contracts that we're signing and our inability to, you know, hold people to account. Like the public sector, the people in charge of signing these contracts have to actually, you know, hold our private sector partners to account. We can't have these massive cost overruns on the public purse.
But when I'm looking at Presto and Orange and streetcar tracks and Union Station, and we're talking about Ontario Place, isn't the savings, if you just ran these big infrastructure projects properly, wouldn't you have more than enough cash to invest in the infrastructure of the city and also programs like some people call vanity plates, like Ontario Place?
Sometimes though, we look at opportunities to, you know, municipalities like Haldon, an example, wouldn't be able to do some of the things that we do if we didn't have these partnerships with private companies. I look at, you know, the Pan Am Games as a perfect example. We partnered with a private company, and I think that our venue for the Equestrian Center was actually the only one, or one of the only ones in the entire province, that came in under time and under budget. And that was in part because we were in a partnership with a private company. And that's something for us to be proud of because it's a win-win for everybody. So I think that there is a time and a place, but I think in a lot of these places, we can only do some of the projects that we do when we have that partnership opportunity.
So Sandy, you're now Premier of Ontario. What do you do to make sure who's got influence and who's got authority in these projects?
Well, I think the first thing that you have to do is establish a new terms of reference and a protocol. To Randy's point, absolutely. You have to craft public policy when it comes to procurement that puts the onus on the contractor, not on the backs of the taxpayer. Now, part of that is you have to engage in revisionist history a little bit, and that's, you know, you're looking at the sins of the past. You're looking at past administrations that have gone down this path, and now all of a sudden, $180 million over budget at Union. I mean, we're dealing with the same thing in Niagara. We got a bridge, Burgoyne Bridge, $50 million. And there's only a handful of us that actually want to solve that problem and get accountability because it's a huge disrespect to the taxpayer. At the end of the day, there's no accountability to why these things ran over.
Some great conversation. We're going to come back afterwards and talk about gun violence in the city. Welcome back, everybody. We're going to talk about, I guess, carnage. I know 11 shootings this weekend, one more this morning. Per capita, we have a higher homicide rate now than New York City. You know, people are talking about, there's a lot of sort of commentary about it. Mayor John Tory said today it left him incredibly angry. We're going to hire 200 more police officers. But we're talking about this level of gang violence, which is almost the more open it is, the more blatant it is, it seems to be the more swagger it produces. And the casualties aren't just other rival gang members. They're innocent bystanders. And it's how we think about the city and how people will view the city in terms of a tourist destination. What can be done? Who wants to go first? Sandy's going at it.
Yeah. So I look at it like this. Toronto wants to become this world-class city. And you're going to have world-class problems. And that's not to say that any time there's a shooting or there's a death, it should be minimized. I get the broken window syndrome. You don't want these things festering into bigger problems. So that's why you have to address it and you have to take it head on. But what I have a problem with is bringing the social justice bat to a gunfight. And I am for harsher penalties, more police officers on the streets, and making sure you crack down at the appropriate time. It seems now is the appropriate time to do a serious crackdown.
Randy?
But I think this is not just a minor problem. Our brand has been Toronto the Good. And, you know, we always had little problems with gun violence, I think, in certain neighborhoods, but it never sort of permeated the vast majority of people's lives because it happened in neighborhoods that you don't live in, and so it never really bothered you. But now we're talking about Kensington at 10 p.m., four people shot. We're talking about Queen and Simcoe or Queen and Peter at 8 p.m. in broad daylight, three people shot. You know, Yorkville at 10 o'clock at night. These are places that people go. These are places that people, the average person is hanging out at. It's not neighborhoods that we would assume this happens. I don't know what the solution is, but I had a very interesting conversation with a couple of police officers. One of them was Black and one of them was Asian. We had a very open conversation because I was very curious about their perspective. What they said to me is all of this started, you can see the timeline is matched with the abolition of carding. And I have no, look, if I was a Black woman and I had three Black sons, I would never want carding. I think it's terrible. Imagine being a mom of three boys and imagine
if you're... I
don't
understand what point are you on. The cops want carding you against that or for it?
I think the cops need to figure out what tools they need. At the same, I don't know that carding people based on, you know, what are you doing when you're carding? You're looking at people who you think might be suspicious. I think that system has been abused in the past. I think there needs to be a new way to do it that doesn't just go after innocent people.
Jennifer. I think that it's going to take an approach of all levels of government working together. I think that there needs to be a very strong push at the provincial and federal level for minimum sentencing. We hear time and time again, the police spend all this effort to catch them, get them into custody, and the next thing you know, they're out on the street again. That's not tolerable. When you commit an offense that involves a weapon, you should be serving a minimum sentence that's consistent across the country, and that needs to happen. I think also the comment about whether or not we should be kicking them out of Toronto housing. If you've been found guilty and of a charge that relates with a gun crime or with a weapon, you're out. You no longer get to live in housing. It's shown that these areas are targeted areas where this is where most of the gun violence occurs. Yes, it's happening around the city now, but this is where it's stemming from. And so we need to get at the root of the cause right there. And I think that
so what do you do with the people you throw out of Toronto housing? What do you do? What's the bigger problem to solve? I think we've got a minority of people that are creating a vast majority of these shootings. What do we do? Do we deport these people if they were first generation? Do we lock them up? What do we bring in anti-terrorism forces to start breaking up? I mean, gangs are about money. This is a commerce. This is not just guys hanging around in the street. There's millions of dollars being generated weekly selling drugs.
I think the first thing you have to do is you have to change the culture and your attitude towards gun violence and homicides in your city. I have no problem bringing a sledgehammer to a problem, not a fly swatter. So right now, you have to drop the hammer and you have to put it out there that this will not be tolerated, and you will utilize everything at your disposal to make sure that this does not repeat itself well into the future. I mean, we're not talking about a situation where there's a one-off. We're talking about escalating gun violence in a city that is supposed to be the safest city in the world. When you talk about Toronto, the good, you better mean it.
So you talk to the police, and I think we're tiptoeing around something here. We're talking to the police. You said it. They want to bring back. They've said this is all began since they stopped carding. Randy, you made a good point, though, but they might have abused carding in the past because there's a lot of innocent people. But is there an answer? Let's find the middle. Is there something that says we have to provide new strategies and tactics to protect the citizens of Toronto?
Right, because in the past, I think a lot of gang members probably didn't carry their weapons with them everywhere they went because they would be worried about being stopped. So they would stash them in certain parts in the city. So if they saw one of their rivals on a street corner, they wouldn't be able to just pull out their weapon and shoot. They'd be like, oh God, I got to go get my weapon. I got to go to wherever. I stashed it. And by the time they got back, the person was gone, or, oh, I'll get them later. Now there's no fear that they're going to be stopped and searched. And so as a result of that, we're seeing a lot more, I think, gun violence. I'm not an expert on any of this, and I don't know what the solution is. I think it's going to be a very tricky political solution, too.
Do we have the political will, Jen?
I think we need to look at the stats, too. Randy brought up an interesting point. You know, how many guns have been seized or collected since carding has stopped? Has it dramatically decreased? You know, we heard a presentation by Peel Regional Police recently, and they haven't confiscated as many guns. They haven't gotten as many as they've had in the previous years. So is there a correlation there? I'm not sure, but that's something that we need to be looking at and making sure that they have the tools that they need to be successful.
Just, you have to make it as uncomfortable as possible for the criminals. You can't give them an easy pass. And I know, listen, I don't want to get into this big debate about, social issues. Because
they're tied. They are tied.
Yeah, but I don't want to conflate it right now. Because what I want to do is I want to suggest that we have to take a hard line. And yeah, you're going to insult some people. Yeah, you're going to offend some people. You're going to do things that aren't necessarily, politically correct. But you have to do something to protect lives.
See, but the calculation, I think the political calculation that people have been making is, okay, we've got this gun violence on one hand, and that's costing us a whole bunch. On the other hand, the collateral damage of it going after innocent young black men, predominantly, who are just good citizens in our city and have nothing to do with any of this violence, there's a societal cost with that. And so how do you... I'm not suggesting it's an easy answer, but I think... But some Randy, political minds and criminal minds and law enforcement minds have to get together to think about how do you bridge the gap.
Randy, I talked about trying to find middle ground, right? Which is it's yes to carding or no to carding doesn't seem to be working.
Right.
Is there middle ground that says, for example, we are going to card 10,000 people a day in Toronto, we're hiring new police officers, and it is purely random. We're not focusing on one race over another, not even focusing on one area of the city. So we all say, hey, you know what? We're going to get carded. That's the price we pay right now. Is there solutions like that that we should be looking at versus just trying to be playing the safe political route listen, we're not talking about a minor problem. There was 11 shootings this weekend.
You do your data mining. You have hotspots in the city. you have these hotspots.
But those, that's where the civil race is. That you're picking on, that just because I live in the project, and the stat says it, 6% of Toronto lives in Toronto housing, 30% of the crime comes from it. But they say, if you just, how about all the other people that aren't criminals? Why are you picking on me?
Yeah. I don't think you're picking on people. You've identified areas that are susceptible to high rates of crime. And that's where your resources should be deployed. I mean, that's not you know, rocket science. That's just common sense. You deploy your resources where there's the highest criminality.
And maybe we employ some resources into actually having minimum sentences so that these people have an opportunity to pick up a new skill, to have a rehabilitation in the sense, so that when they do get out, they have choices and they have options to them.
Great discussion. I think we need to get from rhetoric to reality. Speaking of special, we have Sandy Annunziata in the panel, Jennifer Innes and Randy Ramin, and we're having a great discussion. And I want to shift the topic now to tourism, how important it is, how fantastic it is, and how vital it is for the Canadian economy. By the way, we have one of the greatest countries in the world. So Steve Paikin said, you know what, I want to do something in this. I want to protest this whole NAFTA that's going on. And the best way I can protest is I'm not going to take my annual vacation to the States. I'm going to spend my Canadian dollars at home. Is this something that we should be all embracing? I mean, Dad, I go to your region, which is tourism is everything. Are you doing anything about this sentiment, or are you worried about offending the people in the States?
Well, Niagara is home to 5 international bridge crossings. So our economy is directly, you know, tied into our American neighbors. We love our American neighbors, and we welcome them and spend your money and all that good stuff. But at the end of the day, I mean, Steve Paikin makes some valid points. He wants to support all levels of government that are in this, you know, pissing match with our U.S. trade partners. But I am going to suggest that our greatest ally and our greatest friend are our friends on the American side of the border. And I think they feel the same way about Canada. So even though what you read in the newspapers, a lot of it is rhetoric, a lot of it is political grandstanding, a lot of it is negotiating tactics, I think when you get to the grassroots level, I don't think there's that animosity and that acrimony between our American friends and our Canadian friends.
Okay, so all that thought, Jennifer, I'm going to go back to the question, which Sandy wanted to move on and talk about. Do you think as Canada, we should be doing a national campaign to get people to say, hey, spend your tourist dollars in Canada this year? This is a really great way to support Canadian workers and Canadian jobs. It's easier than trying to figure out how much of this ketchup is tomatoes from one part or the other. This is real business. What do you think?
I think that we should always be doing that. I think that Canada first. Brandy's giving me funny looks, but the reality is this is Canada. You should tour your own country. You should travel. You should know what your own country is about. The East Coast to the West Coast is extremely different from one another. And there's lots of opportunities and lots of things to see and do. I say this, you know, my mom is American. She's now a Canadian, but she was born and raised partially there. And even she says, you know, you should try to love your own country and support your own country. And that's even comes to the fact of buying local. As a counselor, we always tote the fact that we should be shopping local. And when you can buy something and support, you know, Paikin mentions craft brewers. When you have an opportunity to support a small business in your own community, why wouldn't you?
Okay, Miss Amazon shopper heading off to Las Vegas. how are you going to defend this?
Well, I mean, I love what Jen says. It's motherhood and apple pie. And of course, we all agree.
That's an American statement, right?
Sorry, it's maple syrup. It's bacon and maple syrup. But the thing is, we live in a global village, and more so we live in a North American village. And we think of Florida and New York and Las Vegas as part of an extended part of our world, right? So of our immediate world. And I would say, sure, we should all only travel within Canada. But the fact of the matter is, when it's minus 20 in January, you're not going to get much reprieve.
I think he's talking about this summer.
Yeah, right, only this summer.
Well, he's just starting this as a program.
Sure, but this has to continue into the winter months.
And there is
months.
Skiing and things to do in Canada.
Right, sure,
have to go and get a suntan.
I get it.
Okay, I want to shift topics now, because part of the tourism is you take your brand and you bring it to life. Niagara on the Lake, think about it. That great street, you buy those jams, wonderful pillar in the post.
Fudge.
You have those carriages with the horses clopping down the street. Well, now we're dealing with major protests. Animal activists are coming in there and pretty aggressively saying, hey, stop punishing these horses. The days of horse-drawn carriages are over. Randy's going to jump in on the favor of the horses, but Sandy, this is your area.
Listen, I'm a huge fan of entrepreneurship and people establishing their businesses. And when there's these radical elements that are impacting my ability to earn a livelihood, and I'm following the rules, I take exception to that. You know, I'll use Michael Hunt. Is it Michael Hunter or Michael Hunter, the owner of Antler, you know, who had the restaurant here in the city? God bless him. He stood up for what he believed in, and he's reaping the benefits right now. So the same thing is going on in Niagara on the Lake, and God bless the protesters. They don't believe that there should be any horse-drawn carriages. They were very successful in Montreal. The city bylaws passed there that you can no longer have horse-drawn carriages in Montreal. So they took the roadshow to Niagara on the Lake, and now they're causing all kinds of problems and discontent
in
Niagara
on the Lake right now.
Well, coming from the farm, I see things a little bit differently. A lot of these animals are bred to do exactly what they're doing, and they're happiest when they're actually doing it. So to take that away is taking away what some of these horses were bred to do. And if there was violence, or if they weren't well cared for, and if they weren't loved when they're not working and while they are working, then that's a different story. But that's not what these protesters are saying.
But if you're a love animal, you have to understand, people that love animals say, is there not a better way to move people around, like, for example, a double-decker tourist bus than a horse-drawn carriage? Randy, what's your thoughts?
I've always hated seeing those horse-drawn carriages in New York City, south of the border. And it bothered me. If I, you know, maybe there is a middle ground here, speaking of the theme of middle grounds, where the municipality could play a role in making sure that these animals are taken care of safely. Like, do they have to get some kind of permit? And to get that permit, who is auditing how they're treating these animals? Because I think that's what it comes down to. I don't think anyone doubts that a horse can pull a carriage and that it's not too much for the horse. I think what they're saying is, how do we know you're treating your animals well?
No, that's not true. They are fundamentalists.
That's my point of view.
They're fundamentalists, and they are agenda-driven, and they will not be happy until the practice is stopped.
But what does the municipality do? What does the municipality do to make sure that these animals are taken care of?
Well, I mean, there's SPCA, there's veterinary records. I mean, they're very well kept. It matters not.
So at some point they're going to then say you can't horseback ride either, because you shouldn't be riding horses. They're not a mode of transportation anymore. So you're going to get rid of a whole sport industry?
Well, we have to say there's been a lot of things in society that we've moved on to that we might have thought was the wrong behavior, including, you know, having child labor.
We still,
and you say children were bred to be little and go into mines. I mean, we have moved on. So we can't just make the
such
argument.
Such tiny fingers.
tiny fingers. They can find the diamonds in the rocks. So, yeah, you know, it's an interesting point, and it is part of the magic of it. But my wife's the same way. She wants to get out there and just protest. She gets so angry seeing these hot, as she considers, horses. Like, why
and you
are
have
we?
You have no way to know. And a lot of the horses, at least in Central Park, look like they are not doing well. And you wonder who's actually watching how these horses are being treated.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, what a wonderful panel. Thank you for breaking me in on the first day of my Jerry Agar show.